You're listening to the Global Ooj Podcast, where every week we learn about the world through the eyes of entrepreneurship with your host, Ujjwal Velagapudi.
If you've ever played sports at any level, I'm sure at one point or another, you've envisioned yourself actually playing the sport as a professional athlete. Today, I had the pleasure of speaking with a professional in the sports world, spanning multiple continents and numerous countries. Michael McCobb had started as an amateur footballer, and after injuries ended his playing career, he shifted to coaching and quickly rose through the ranks, eventually coaching at the highest level as a professional head coach. Oh, and he even worked his way up to owning the bridge construction business he started working at. And this was all while he was actually still playing. This will come full circle with some of the projects he's involved with today, so stay tuned for that. I learned a lot here today with Mike, not just the tactical aspect, but it was more so the fundamentals of what it truly takes to be a successful sports agent. I was excited to speak with Mike before, but I'm even more excited to see how Mike and his loyal team at ProSport International will continue to build out their holistic sports management organization. Thank you so much for joining the Global Ooj podcast. I appreciate you coming on, and like I was saying before, absolutely, genuinely excited to be able to chat with you here today.
And likewise, thank you so much for the invitation. As I said, I've followed some of your podcasts, and I think they're really fantastic. And for me, it's delightful that I'm able to speak to somebody on a different continent or in a different continent, and you know, share some of my thoughts and experiences relating to my life, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and honestly, I have so many questions, but we'll just start with a basic. If you can tell me, you know, if I'm meeting you for the first time right now, if you can just give me a little background about who Mike is and maybe where you had grown up and kind of how you came to be here right now.
Okay, so of Lebanese descent. South African born in Johannesburg, moved to Durban with my parents and my sister, who's my only sibling, when I was 5 years old, and that's some 60 years ago, and spent the majority of my youth in Durban, schooled in Durban, and then decided at the end of my school period to do my tertiary education in Johannesburg, went back to Johannesburg, spent some time there. Went to the military, which in those days was compulsory. So spent 2 years in the military. At the same time, qualified as an analytical chemist, believe it or not, worked for Coca-Cola, and then gave it up. Didn't enjoy it at all, and decided to become a laborer on a construction site because that was, was really something that interested me. Construction interested me. At that time as well, I met my childhood sweetheart, my wife Charmaine. We got together when I was 19, she was 16. Got married when I was 23, and she was turning 20. We've been together for 46 years. Wow. We have three children. My son runs our European global operation. He's based in Stockholm. My two daughters are in businesses of their own, married. Got five grandchildren. And blessed in the fact that they live in Durban, mm-hmm. Where I am. So my daughters and their partners and my grandchildren, we see each other on a regular basis. So back to construction, worked my way up, finally bought shares in the company, and my partner and I built it into one of the top four or five independent construction companies in the province. Heavy construction, did big river bridges, major construction in factories. And then always had passion for sport, played amateur football, never quite good enough to play at a higher level, but had an intriguing interest in coaching because Clive Barker was my coach. He became, as you know, the most successful of all national team coaches. And through that, when I had my knee injury, I think I was 27 years old, I decided to continue coaching, and I coached amateur football, and it was really a crazy rise, a meteoric rise, because Some 5-6 years later, I'd only had 1 year of professional football coaching Manning Rangers, and I did extremely well with them. I say this humbly, but I did extremely well with them. And then received a call which really changed my life. It turned my whole life upside down. It was from Dr. Arvin Causa, the chairman of the PSL, owner of Orlando Pirates. And he offered me the job at Orlando Pirates. And that was after 1 year in the professional ranks. And I'm sure you'll know that in terms of South African football, the big two in South African football in terms of support are Orlando Pirates and Kaizer Chiefs. Mm-hmm. And Mamelodi Sundowns are obviously a big, big player in South African football, now probably the most successful team in the decade. So I joined Orlando Pirates in 94, sold my shares in my construction company, moved back to Johannesburg. And again, I think, you know, fortune favors the brave. They hadn't won the league title in 19 years. It was an era dominated by Kaizer Chiefs, and we became league champions in 94. So that was my first year. We won two knockout cups in 95 and finished second in the league. And then Orlando Pirates went on to win the Champions League. So that was in 95, became champions of Africa. I left just before the final to come back to Durban to rejoin my family. My assistant coach took the final, and we beat ASEC Mimosa in a dramatic game away from home to win the Champions League. 96, I became technical advisor to the national team. Clive Barker was coach, so we reunited, and we became champions of Africa. 97, we qualified for the World Cup for the first time in our history, for the 98 World Cup. Oh, wow. And then, surprisingly, all lost our jobs. But that happens in football.
It does.
So I often say to Clive, we were dismissed for our success, I guess. I'm not so sure what happened, to be honest. But I think that put a whole lot of things in perspective in my life. You know, very strong family man, and have a very strong spiritual belief. So for me to be away from my family for any given period of time was never going to happen again. And for me to move a young family around, because I don't have to tell you, as a football coach, you go where your next job is. Right. And I realized it was always a short-lived period. Mm-hmm. And I didn't want to move around like a gypsy any longer. So I retired at a young age, much to the dismay of many people in the industry, and got back into construction, but on a consultancy basis. And as fate would have it, a young man walked into my home one day with his mom and asked me if I'd look after his career. And I knew nothing about it, but I've been involved in business for a long, long period of time. And so it was probably the natural progression for me to marry my love for football and sport in general with business. And I agreed. And his name is Siyabonga Nomveti. Siyabonga, at the age of 19, then moved from African Wanderers to Kaizer Chiefs. And from there, we moved him to Udinese in Italy. He spent a time in Italy playing in Serie A football, and then won the league in Denmark with Aalborg, won the league with Djurgården in Sweden. Mm-hmm. We then brought him back to South Africa, and he's a legend. Right. He retired last year at the age of 42. So he's been with me. Yeah. He's been with me for forever. His entire career. We're now working with him in his post career, as he's getting his coaching badges and his brand ambassador to a number of brands. But that really kicked me off in a company which I then formed called Promark Sport. My first three rugby clients were Springboks, mm-hmm. or future Springboks. They were 18 or 19 at the time. My first two cricket clients, one of which is the famous Sean Pollock. Again, we're youngsters and turned out to be top-class cricket players. And that really launched Promark Sport. In 2001, I then merged with the biggest rugby agency in South Africa, Player Sport. We put the two together, and that's how Pro Sport was really birthed. That was in April 2001. So in April next year, it's our 20th anniversary.
Wow.
We've grown as a company. We have offices in in Africa, probably 10 different countries in Africa, four different countries in Europe, and three offices here in South Africa, which has always been our home base. Durban is my hometown, so that's where the head office is, conveniently. But we've expanded our offering from a pure player management offering to an holistic sports management offering with procurement of sponsorships and brand building and eventing, hospitality, incoming tours, and that sort of thing. So have a beautiful complement of people, the large number of which have been with me for since inception.
Oh, wow.
So for the last 15 to 20 years, very, very small staff turnover and a happy place. Mm-hmm. We're a very, very happy company driven by a very deep purpose of making a difference to those lives with whom we come into contact. And that honestly is the why of ProSport International, the reason why we do what we do. Yes, of course we're commercial. Of course we are also driven by being successful. But honestly, that success has come as a byproduct of our deep core value, which is to help as many people along the way in sport in particular.
And I think that's amazing, especially with the staff turnover. I think even internally, that speaks volumes to you and the culture and the overall company. And I definitely have a lot of questions on what you're doing today, but just to rewind all the way back, you said 60 odd some years ago, going back to your schooling years. I think that's got to be a lie.
Yes.
I don't know. Might be the bald head, but
yeah, I'm turning 66 on the 2nd of March.
That's crazy.
So a couple of months down the line, but it's got a lot to do with how you approach life and your mindset.
And when did you? So I was waiting for you to say something about sports, and then you kicked it in with, you know, your football career.
Yes.
So when did that actually happen, where you were running the construction business and you were playing as well? Did that coexist? Did you simultaneously do that from your schooling days? Oh wow! So you managed both careers full time.
Yes, and so when I took up my first full-time professional coaching job at Manning Rangers in the top flight in South African football, in those days, a large number of players were part-time.
Mm-hmm.
So we could only train in the evenings, which suited me. So I would literally, and I'm not exaggerating, get up at 4 o'clock in the morning. That's where my day would start. I would spend the majority of my time at the company, at Sangro Construction in those days. And then in the evening, five times Monday to Friday, from 6 o'clock to 8 o'clock, we would then commence with our football side of the business. It was a long, long day. It was 4 o'clock in the morning, and I'd literally get home at 9 o'clock at night. And then, as you can imagine, there was weekend work and there were weekend games. And I realized that that wouldn't last forever. Mm-hmm. And that's why when I received the call from Ivan Causa, from Dr. Causa, it was decision time. Mm-hmm. I either had to continue with construction and give up football, or give up my livelihood in construction and start with football. So that was the decision I made, and quite honestly, very, very happy I made that decision, because the crazy thing is that I joined Pirates on the 3rd of March, 1994, a day after my birthday,
mm-hmm.
and Madiba, Nelson Mandela, was inaugurated hardly a month later.
Wow.
as the first democratic president of South Africa. Mm-hmm. And Orlando Pirates was a team that was closely linked to the African National Congress, the ANC.
Mm-hmm.
So it was definitely something that that I was very fortunate mm-hmm. in being able to put together my changing career at the same time as we became free in South Africa.
And so why did, or what led to the Pirates giving you a call in particular? What was it about Mike at the age of 27 that was it your skill set on the field, was it your acumen off the field, or just your IQ as a player?
No, so at 27 I retired from playing football because of the injury, but I only started coaching at the age of 28, okay. 29, and then a lot of amateur football coaching, and then got involved on the third tier of semi-professional, was professional football, won the league with a team called Stella, moved into the NFD, the National First Division, which is the second tier of South African football, with a team crazily named Crystal Brains, a very, very small team. And we ran Cape Town Spurs, excuse me, which was the big team in the NFD. We ran them to the wire. We finished second that year. And then I was offered the job at Manning Rangers.
Okay.
That was in the top tier. So, but it was really unheard of for a coach to go from third division to second division to first division, and then a year later to the head coaching position at the age of 38, right. Which was very young at that stage, at a team like Orlando Pirates. But I guess it was the style that I brought to the game. I'd like to believe, and I'm not blowing my own trumpet, but I have to share this with you if I'm going to be real. In those days, the majority of football in the world was played in a 4-4-2 system, okay. With the famous libero, the player at the back that used to be free and sweep.
Yeah, I played sweeper.
Sweeper in this country. Did you play sweeper? Yeah. So the sweeper was the guy that watched the game, controlled the game, and cleaned up behind his defense.
Loved it.
I decided to go flat.
Okay.
So we played a flat four. Played a sweeper in front of the four, uh-huh. So a defensive midfielder, which is used today. Yeah. This was in 94, don't forget, 26 years ago. And then we played with three in front of them. Uh-huh. So it was a 4-2-3-1.
4-2-3-1, yeah.
Actual fact, we played a 4-2-3-1 or we played a 4-1-4-1.
4-1-4, okay.
4-1-4-1.
So four flat midfielders?
Four flat midfielders, okay. One defensive midfielder, two box-to-box midfielders, two wide midfielders that played as wingers when we went forward and tucked in when we defended, and one sole striker. Okay. And we were very difficult to contain because we pressed. Mm-hmm. And again, no team's ever pressed because you could only press if you played flat. Right. You couldn't afford to press if you played with one spare player at the back. Right. So we pressed and we played a high line. Mm-hmm. And it was purely the way that – and you must understand, I couldn't learn that from the coaches that I had played for because of the fact that they weren't playing in that style. So it was really a style of football that was new in the world, never been used in South Africa. And
why did
I guess
you...
I was dumb enough.
Okay, go on.
I was dumb enough.
Okay.
And naive enough to believe that I could get it to work. Okay. And it really did work. I must say it did.
That's amazing. Okay.
So that's how I really jumped into football. Mm-hmm. Had no academic qualifications. Mm-hmm. So in those days, you didn't have to have a license, but most people had gone to various schools, mm-hmm. Schools of football. One that I did enroll in, which I never went to, was in Italy. It was one of the most famous schools, Arrigo Sacchi. Arrigo Sacchi did his learnership there, and then he became one of the lecturers there later on. And so it was basically self-taught from studying different styles of football, from looking at the way different coaches set up things and just implementing what I truly believed in. I was fortunate. I think it could have gone either way.
No, but it's amazing that things did work out. And obviously I think throughout your career, you've done so many different things and had so many steps and stints at each location that I think if it weren't for such a strong foundation and fundamental, you know, it probably wouldn't have worked on the surface level. So what throughout each stage, you know, obviously you said that discipline to have the understanding that, okay, you got married at, you said 23, so you had a family.
23.
And you had the business, you scaled the business simultaneously progressing your football career. And I mean, where do you think that foundation for you to progress, and that aspect where you could always fall back on and say, hey, this is me. I know I can, you know, tackle anything ahead of me, but I've got this foundation because, you know, was it a certain rite of passage or a certain stint that you hit where you had that confidence to be able to tackle anything going forward?
No, it's crazy. I never grew up as the most confident person, although academically I did well. I was an ordinary sportsman, but worked really hard. So I played a lot of top class sport at school, but only through my endeavors, because I was never gifted with pace, never gifted. I've got the flattest feet, I think, in the world. So never gifted with pace, but always had a very good brain, I believe, in sports. So I could think things through. And I had to do that because, as I said, wasn't blessed physically. So I think that foundation and my love for sport came through my school days and the spirit that I saw it build in a group of people. That intrigued me, how different characters with different levels of education and acumen and different levels of talent were able to come together as a team and produce some really incredible results. So that intrigued me. But I think I wasn't a very confident guy growing up. I was fortunate enough to meet my soulmate at an early stage, and she's been the rock of my life because she's enabled me to move on and do things that my heart has really felt important to do, while she was looking after my kids or our kids. I was able to follow a career, but I also think that inherent in me as a character was a fierce determination to endeavor to be the best at what I did. And I've always tried to instill that in people that I come into contact with. If you don't shoot for the stars, you're never going to reach the sky. You have to shoot high in life. And even if it's unrealistic, you have to dream. And then get up and implement your dream, mm-hmm. or at least give it your best shot. And I haven't been as successful in certain things that I've tackled as I would have liked to have been, but that wouldn't have been for one moment a lack of trying, mm-hmm. or a lack of passion and enthusiasm. It was purely that maybe I just didn't have the gifting or the talent in that particular area to reach the heights that I'd set for myself. But I've learned later in my life, in the latter part of my life, that the journey is the most important thing, not the end result. I've learned that if you can't be happy doing what you're doing, and literally every moment of what you're doing, including the challenges, I've said this over and over again to everybody I speak to. If you can tell me that you've woken one day, and then closed your eyes that evening without one challenge presenting itself in your day, then I don't think you're telling the truth. That challenge may be a sore tooth. It may be getting your finger stuck in a door. It may be losing a loved one. It may be a deal that hasn't come to fruition. But we'll have challenges every single day of our lives. And I don't think we even should look at them as challenges. I think we should look at them as part and parcel of a thing called life. And we're blessed, absolutely blessed, to be able to get up in the morning and breathe and do the things that we love doing. And so if you're expecting it to be a bed of roses all day and every day, you're going to be hugely disappointed. And do I get disappointed? Of course I get disappointed. We're all human, and we all understand that there is a human factor to everything that we do. So we flesh and we blood, and we're going to feel hurt and we're going to feel disappointment. But it's how you handle that and how you recover from it, how quickly you recover from it, that really determines, I believe, your happiness in life. And so that's what I'm striving for. It's a new chapter in my life now. I've started to do a whole series of things that I've never done before, meditation and all of these sort of things, cold showers in the morning and different diets and experimenting with a different part of my life, mainly what's up here, my mind. And so I'm still as enthusiastic today as I have ever been about my life.
That's amazing. And I 100% agree about what you were saying about one, just showing gratitude for yourself every single day, making sure that, you know, we are here where we are, fortunate to be where we are and to have that passion every single day. And then also about, I was trying to get at, as far as your rock, you saying it was your partner and trying to, get to that side is, you know, obviously strong familial backing is of course going to enable you to do that throughout your career as well. And also being able to enjoy the journey and not exactly the end result, because I tell myself that every single day. I mean, even in whatever I've done, it's just to be happy every single day in whatever I'm doing, because I know that I look back in my life right now, what I did years ago, I love it and it's nostalgic, but I'm in that present state today where in 5 years I'll be looking back to today, how, you know, I was talking to Mike halfway around the world. You know, it's some of these things that you're going to enjoy. So enjoy it while we're actually here today. But some of these...
Well, you just said something...
Oh, sorry. Go.
Sorry, you just said something very profound, and that you said... we here in the present state, and the most important thing I don't have to tell you is to be present, because so often, you know, we're having this discussion, but our mind is on what happened yesterday, and maybe something that happened that wasn't that great, is still lodged somewhere in our mind, and then we're still thinking of what we're going to be doing later in the afternoon, and we truly don't enjoy this moment to its fullest. So, being present, I think, is the most important thing.
And you were talking about some of the things that you started doing. Is that, was that a post-COVID effect or just more time?
Yes.
It was? Okay.
No, crazy. So, you know, we had lockdown on the 26th of March, 2020. And, my son, Michael, one of the things that he does, and he does it for our company, is flow state. Which is, if you want to call it, in sporting parlance, it's when an individual or a team is in the zone, when everything just seems to be happening effortlessly and seamlessly and perfectly. And so it's a state of mind. So he started me on this journey of meditation and working harder with my mind. I train every single day physically, but working harder with my mind as one of the most important aspects of what I do. Also referred me to some great readings. I mean, one of my favorite people and one of my favorite authors, and he's more than an author, he calls himself an optimist, is Simon Sinek. And I've listened to some of his podcasts and I've read some of his books, which are incredible. And so that's my new journey. My new journey is a journey of new enlightenment, of educating myself in a different way, of trying to become a better person in every single way. And my hierarchy of importance in life is God, my family, my relationships, and the rest fall into place. And honestly, those are the three things that I work on every single day of my life. I don't have to work on it too hard anymore. It's almost a default in my system now. But I need to educate myself more in areas that I'm not educated or lack education. And hopefully by doing that, interacting with people going forward can make a more meaningful and significant difference to their lives, hopefully. So that's really what drives me on a daily basis, is just to become a better person and to have a better effect on those that I come into contact
with. Yeah, I can 100% relate, especially post-COVID. I've started to do this over the last couple of years, but it was really COVID that, you know, we're stuck in this room for months on end with nothing else to do. So started down the path of meditation, never truly did that before. Yoga, changed my diet completely and just trying to be a lot healthier, not just physically, which I've always tried to do, but like you were saying, more the mental aspect, because, you know, the physical aspect, it's being involved in sports and athletics throughout your life, it'll come as second nature. You know, we can always do it, but it's the mental aspect, I think, which takes a different level of fitness on a daily basis to be fit mentally and to keep that going. So I definitely agree. It's definitely a journey that you need to work on every single day and progress.
I agree.
As far as, you know, I'm sure that state is more, would you say more recent? And as far as, you know, going back all the way to the construction business, I just want to get into that a little bit more, because in your early 20s, you were working at this company. And then how did that actually progress? Because did you have that drive to say, I want to own this company one day? Or was it, you know, I want to get a minority stake and then eventually buy them out, and then it just progressed naturally? Or how did that come about?
You know, I think like everything in my life and everything that I've done, yes, obviously you have to have end goals, and there has to be objectives. But I do think that somewhere deep inside of me, although I wasn't conscious of it, there's always been a deeper purpose to what I've done. And I would like to believe that the reason I got involved in construction was because we could then make a tangible difference to the landscape in many ways. And if you look at it from a life cycle point of view, it's quite interesting that one of the most significant things that I did was build river bridges. Mm-hmm. And I don't have to tell you, a river bridge bridges the gap between the one side of the river and the other side, for various reasons, either for vehicular traffic or for pedestrian traffic or for a number of other reasons, and maybe a combination of both, to make life a little bit easier for those living on the one side who want to get to the other side. And so that for me was something that really, really grabbed my heart. And you know, when you see a structure of that sort come out of a riverbed in form of really big foundations and then columns that hold beams and then that holds your major structure, and you finally see the end product where you physically see a motor vehicle or a person or both move from one side to the other, is incredibly gratifying. And just yesterday had a conversation with a company that has asked us to help them. It's a new education college that wants to integrate sport and education, which I think is a fantastic thing, because too often we have education facilities that don't cater for sport, and then you have sporting facilities that don't cater for education. The truth is, of every 20, 30, 40, 50 youngsters who have these aspirations of becoming great sportsmen, only a handful are going to do that, and the rest have to educate themselves, even if it's in sport, mm-hmm. as administrators or coaches or whatever. So what a wonderful idea to have a college that caters for both academics and for sport, not on an equal basis, but almost on an equal basis. And it's called New Bridge.
That's amazing.
And we were talking about...
Comes full circle.
We were talking about... And I was saying, you know, there is a problem in South African sport in that a lot of kids who play sport, and sporting at school in this country is really taken seriously, so much so that you've got directors of sport at schools now, which was unheard of in my days. You've got top coaches coaching top teams at schoolboy level. You've got high performance centers within schools. So all of these nutrition programs within schools. So all of these things are new age, fairly new age, probably the last decade or so, where it's really stepped up. But the problem is you then have a whole group of young men and boys, men and women, boys and girls, who then leave school, and some of them are not quite there, not quite good enough to go into the top sporting academies in the country, and they get lost to the system. Yeah. So I was speaking with the CEO of Newbridge College yesterday and said to him, you know, when we speak about this, I see it, and please forgive me. I said to him, forgive me for the pun. I see it as bridging the gap between school leavers who are adept in sport and professional sportsmen, because we don't have that in our tertiary education systems other than at a handful of universities. So he said, well, it's not the pun. That's the exact reason why we named it Newbridge, to bridge the gap for that very reason that you're talking about. So it took me back to my days of construction, bridging the gap between one landmass and another.
It's a newfound passion, and you can comes full circle again. So, I mean, that's
crazy.
What you were saying, it's as far as the last decade, it sounds to me like you were describing America. So as far as the athletic culture and the way sports work in America here, I mean, it's, I mean, kids are started extremely young at a very, very, very young age. And so, especially with scholarships right now. And so I wanted to ask with, how does that system work where either in Europe or in Africa, or even locally in South Africa, upon leaving 12th standard or, you know, the high school level,
grade 12,
do athletes go professionally, or is it a kind of a feeder system? Do they go into the minors and then thereafter, or is there a university level where they are offering some sort of incentive for these athletes, like a free education, like a scholarship?
Yes. So I think it's across all of those topics that you've just mentioned. Now, the top sportsmen and women are identified by top sporting bodies
at the like yourself,
and they have their eye. They have their eye on them, and even contract with them whilst they're still at school. So that's what. That's really the cream of the crop that are forward in terms of their development in sport and have shown to be potentially top class sportsmen and women of the future.
Can you say at what age?
So they've taken up 14, 15 years old.
Okay, wow. Yeah,
pretty early. So probably in grade 9, grade 10.
Wow.
Standard grade 9, standard 7, standard 8.
Yeah. Wow.
So it's pretty early. That's a handful, cream of the crop throughout. And I'm going to talk about South Africa as a system, for example, because it happens throughout the world. That happens annually, where the cream of the crop is already pre-contracted, so that when they leave school one day, they already go into their first professional contract.
Wow.
The next level would be a level of youngsters that would be good enough to go into top academies. They might not be contracted, but they'll be offered bursaries, part bursaries to go into top academies, either at big sporting bodies or at universities, certain universities that have a good sporting curriculum. So that's the next level. The third level is the level that often get lost, because quite often kids are late developers, particularly those that, and I know that in America, I've read a book by Malcolm Gladwell called Outliers, and he says it there, says it's crazy. When you look at the draft system in American sport, the majority of those that are drafted when they leave school or college are those that are born in the first 3 months of the year. And it's not coincidental. It's the same in this country, because if you're born in Jan, Feb, or March, for example, but particularly even in January, if you're born in January or you're born in December, on the 1st of January the following year, you're still in a certain age group. So if the age group, for example, is under 17,
right.
If I'm born on the 31st of December, I'm under 17 on the 1st of January, okay? If I'm born on the 1st of January the year before, I'm still under 17 because I'm turning 17 on the 1st of January.
So you get that advantage. Okay?
12 months of physical development at a young age is a massive advantage. Okay. And particularly at school level. So if I'm, for example, and let's talk about South African rugby, which you can equate with American football. Mm-hmm. If I'm a 70 kilogram kid playing rugby, and I'm now contesting against an 80 kilogram kid in the same position, which requires physical strength, I'm not going to be in the elite squad at school. I'm probably going to be one level below the elite squad. So my level of competition is going to be lower than that of the older, bigger boy who's in the same age group. Okay. What then happens is that you find that group of kids that are born later in the year are disadvantaged from the point of view that they aren't put into elite programs unless they are absolutely exceptional. Lionel Messi has to be an example. Mm-hmm. Small, exceptional. So his size was never going to be a major disadvantage to him. But those are an exception to the rule. So those are the kids that are normally lost to the system. And believe it or not, you'll get quite a nice percentage of those kids that will come through and play at the highest level and possibly even excel. Mm-hmm. So that's why I believe there has to be some form of tertiary education that also caters for maybe not the elite sports person who's already been snapped up by the top bodies or top academies, but maybe the next level. Right. Because even if you have 200-300 of them and 5% come through the system, that's another 15 mm-hmm. who are going to make a top-class career in professional sports.
So on that same note, all these athletes, the remaining 95%, what happens? I mean, do you... What generally happens? I mean, there's always stats that I see, even in U.S. college games, where they're saying, you know, there's only a very small percentage of some of these college athletes that are on scholarship. They go on to the professionals or, you know, at the Olympics and whatnot. But everybody else has a career after this, so they're promoting their own organizations and their own schools. But for, like you were saying, many students may not, or many athletes may not have that option. Maybe not today, unless new programs like Newbridge come about. So how, what does that life look like? And even let's say an athlete goes on to play for 2 years, 3 years, or even like yourself, playing for a handful of years, but injuries derail everybody's career at some extent, or just the body can't take it anymore. So let's say it's a short-lived career of 2-3 years. What typically happens?
Yeah. The biggest problem is the fact that if you don't marry almost on a concurrent basis, some form of education, mm-hmm. whether it be life experience or academic qualification, while you're playing the sport, mm-hmm. you end up going into the big world with
nothing. Yeah,
with very, very few tools to be successful. And that's understandable. So we're always encouraging our young athletes that we represent to do something, whether it be a part-time course, whether it be part-time work. Mm-hmm. Nobody can tell me that as a professional athlete, if you're training 3-4 hours a day, including your video sessions and your recovery, some days may be more, you don't know, but some days may be less, that you shouldn't involve yourself with something outside of your sport just to basically become more wholesome as a person. So we call it life after sport within our organization, within Pro Sport. It's a life after sport program. We want to, that's why we're talking to a college like Newbridge. We want to improve that and to involve mentorship programs at companies. Mm-hmm. So for example, let's say I'm a professional football player, I'm a professional baseball player, and I'm really talented, super talented. And it's going to, with everything being equal, if I have a pretty injury-free career, and I have a good lifestyle, because we all know that that is so important. So many talented sportsmen end up throwing their careers away through poor life decisions. If at the end of the day I'm that talented, but I have this concern about what to do with my life if something happens that shortens my career, and I don't have an academic drive, why not go and do a mentorship course within an organization in sales, for example, something that interests you? You might say, well, you know, maybe post-career, I still want to stay in sport, but I don't want to coach, and I don't want to be an administrator. I wouldn't mind getting involved in the technical side of selling sporting equipment, mm-hmm. and maybe developing sporting equipment to help sporting companies do that sort of thing. Go and do mentorship.
Right.
Because even if you're doing 4 or 5 hours a week, you're opening your mind to something that ordinarily you wouldn't be exposing yourself to. And it can only enhance your life. Mm-hmm. It can't have a negative effect on your life. It'll also take you away from a potential mischief, because you won't have enough true. Time to do the things you shouldn't be doing.
I definitely believe in that. Yeah, trying to stay busy as possible so that you stay focused on
correct
the task at hand. Yeah. But yeah, I definitely agree that. Is that something that has also changed? Because as the money has increased over the years with, let's say, some of these athletes, they no longer are required to get a part-time job or do anything else on the side. Has that slowly been shifting? Whereas before, maybe even as one of the premier athletes, maybe in the off season, you do need a full-time job to compensate for your family. But has that changed as salary caps and incomes grown over the past few decades?
Yeah, I don't even think it has to do with having a second job to implement, you know, to complement your income.
Not just financial.
I think it has more to do with the transition from sport to non-sport.
Right.
So what I'm trying to say is, we had it with a top class rugby player. Was one of the first rugby players that I looked after. Mm. He was 18 years old, and he stayed with me until he was 32, 33 years old. And I saw his transition successfully into business, into farming. Mm-hmm. And so it wasn't a financial thing for him. He had really invested his money wisely. We had assisted him with those investments. He had planned for his career after sport. However, the transition from being a famous sportsman to being a farmer was what took its toll, because it was a sudden change. Right. So there was farming within his family. So it wasn't as if he was going to something that wasn't set up for him to start a career in, but he wasn't mentored in that while he was playing his rugby. So when he ended up stopping playing rugby, no more adoration from hundreds of thousands of supporters, a totally different lifestyle. Outside of the financial differences, it was a great culture shock. So much so that he had to come back at the age of 34 and play another 2 years.
Oh, wow. Okay.
in preparation for his life after sport. Mm-hmm. And that's why I believe it is so important to have these programs in place. Yeah. Often we neglect them, and not only sportsmen neglect them, or sportswomen. When I say sportsmen, please forgive me, sportsperson, sportswoman as well. Okay. Not only do the sportswomen neglect them, the mentorship programs and the academic programs while they're playing sport, it's the sporting bodies themselves that don't have, a number of them have programs which are good for window dressing and good for image, but definitely aren't practical and aren't effective. Mm-hmm. And so that's something that I would dearly love, before I close my eyes, to implement within our company, is to have a practical and effective mentorship program that makes a real difference to the lives of all sports persons. And the truth is, you can't force somebody to do something. Mm-hmm. You can lead a horse to water, you can't force it to drink, but you can at least offer that opportunity and advice and be persistent right. with your nagging until such time as you realize you're not going to progress with this. But I believe that these programs are vital.
Yeah. And there's I've seen this where a lot of companies do seek out athletes, you know, at least in the States, you know, they seek out certain athletes of certain sports or just athletes and college athletes in general, just because of certain attributes that they bring to the table. And so, right. like you were saying about, you know, you can't lead the horse to the water, but, or you can't make it drink it. But if an athlete has the same drive and determination and discipline and work ethic that they had in their respective sport in their post-life career, it would be, I'm in Los Angeles right now, and just off the top of my head comes the late Kobe Bryant, where in his career he was very successful, but then also thereafter he was very successful in, you know, his endeavors afterwards. So, So as far as those attributes and some of those things, is there, just speaking to maybe the business owners that will be hearing this, and even myself, because I've always wanted to do some of those programs, but I never thought about it in this light. How exactly are you looking to set it up? And even if I can share this with somebody else and just articulate it, what exactly would you want to envision, and what sort of culture do you think it would require, and what sort of attributes or roles would most easily be adaptable to their current skill set?
Yeah, I think the most important thing is to have buy-in from a number of different organizations. Mm-hmm. You need your tertiary education organizations to buy into this concept. And the more that buy in, the better. You need as many big corporations and smaller corporations to buy into this concept and have mentorship programs for top sportsmen, or for sportsmen who are currently plying their trade in sport. And there needs to be harmony between the sporting body that employs the athlete, the corporation that is happy to offer the mentorship program, and the education facility that provides the academic arm to this program. Mm-hmm. And yes, it sounds complicated, but truth be told, when I look at one of our rugby players, a guy by the name of Tendai Mtawariri, they call him the Beast. Of Zimbabwean birth, came to South Africa and became one of the highest capped Springboks of all time. And Tendai ended up midway through his career in a mentorship program with a security company who happened to have one of its major shareholders as a former rugby Springbok.
Okay.
So he understood the importance of this. And Tendai retired a couple of years ago, a year ago, from playing professional rugby, and is now the director of his own company within this group.
Wow. Yeah.
So that for me is the absolute perfect example of what can be achieved if you have a proper program in place and you have a willingness from all parties involved to participate in the program. And honestly, it will change lives dramatically. Those that are involved with sport will find such happiness in their life after sport, because a lot become very depressed and don't really know what to do with themselves.
Right.
And that's irrespective of whether they have secured themselves financially or not.
That's absolutely true.
We've seen it.
That's amazing. And Mike, I definitely want to connect even after, because I think on that front, I can definitely already start to picture a few companies, not on a large scale, definitely, but on a smaller, more intimate level.
Wonderful. Absolutely.
That could definitely assist in that process. So we'll definitely touch base afterwards.
Wonderful.
And more folks that may come to mind. But just to get an idea of your pro sports on a global scale, what sports do you provide services for? And in what regions are you more focused in, or where's your footprint right now?
Okay, so let me tell you that our primary sport is football or soccer, as you would know it in the States. Our major footprint is in Africa and Europe, as you would imagine. But we do have a small presence in the States. We have a small presence in Asia, but primarily, as you would expect, in Africa and Europe. On the rugby front, again, small presence in the States, and small presence in Asia, a lot, and in Europe, but Europe more the UK. So let's say post Brexit, the UK, we have associate offices in France, Italy, and England. We've previously had company owned offices in Wales and Scotland. But the model has changed, and we now have associate offices in the UK, France, and Italy. Cricket, again, nothing in the States, nothing in Asia at this point in time, but we do have a small footprint in the UK, and a big footprint in South Africa.
Okay.
And then we also, on the individual side, we look after, on a much smaller basis, golf, tennis, swimming, athletics, but on a small basis. So when I say a smaller basis, more handpicked, youngsters who we want to assist in their development, both of their sporting side and their academic side. But our three major sports are football, rugby, and cricket.
Okay. And roughly how many athletes do you currently manage right now?
So on the player management side, because as I explained to you, we have a non-player management arm to our business, which is the commercial side, sports commercial side of our business. We look after approximately 300 sports personalities globally.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
And if you want me to break it down, 200 in football, probably 40 in rugby, 30 in cricket, and the balance across other sports.
Wow. So with that, 300, I can just imagine 300. How does that work internally within your team? Is it kind of maybe a sport account manager and then a specific agent for certain types of sports, or is it across the board? Hey, this region, you know, a few individuals get all of South Africa and some get the UK, or how does that?
So we work, we set up our offices and our structures first and foremost on a geographical basis. Because as you can imagine, if we're looking after a number of players in Europe, we can't do it from Africa. So our two company owned offices are in Sweden and Belgium. And our associate offices are in Greece and Germany.
Okay.
Actually placed our first player our first Greek player through our office in Greece, our pro sport office in Greece. My associate, Pascalis Tunturis, placed our first player at Liverpool, Konstantinos Tsimikas.
Wow.
So that was a great moment for us. We've placed players in the Premiership, but not at Liverpool. So that was a great moment for us. So firstly, we set it up geographically. And then secondly, we would set it up, let's call it categorically.
Okay.
So rugby, cricket, football, individual. So we wouldn't have one account manager looking after all three sports in one geographical region.
Okay, right.
So in each of our geographical regions, each of our geographical offices, we would have mostly football, rugby, and cricket handled by different regional managers. Some regions can be handled by one person. So for example, in rugby, instead of having three regional managers in our three offices in Durban, Cape Town, and Johannesburg, we've got two that look after our national footprint. But then we have a big support structure. So within the company, we have consultants on investment and taxation, and and career development. And so that's within one office space. Mm-hmm. And we provide that service across the globe. Yeah, to everybody. Is that, because it's logical. It's all,
is that internal, or sorry, is that do you partner?
Part internal, part external, okay, with associates that we've had a great relation, and I've personally had relationships mm-hmm. with in my personal capacity. Okay. Because one has to also be careful that we don't prescribe to our athletes where to invest and who, you know, who to do their taxes for mm-hmm. them, etc. But we offer them that service. Okay. So they have the option of doing it in-house. Right. And thankfully, a large number of them do, because we have a good track record yeah. with them, and we're very conservative in terms of our approach in their investments. Mm-hmm. Except if they've earned a lot of money and they come to us and say, right, we know that you've been cautious with our investments, but now we want to be a little bit risky with X amount. Mm-hmm. We'll advise them on those issues. And if we don't want to get our hands dirty, we'll say, we're not interested and we advise against it. Please don't do it. But again, we can't force people to do what they don't know, or, you know, what we want them to do and what they don't want to mm-hmm. do. They've got to realize we've been in the business for over 2 decades yeah. and the advice we've given them is based on 2 decades of experience.
And so let's just say they are, you know, I'm a hotshot athlete. I am one of your clients, and you're providing all these services, full-fledged, you know, end-to-end yes. services. But do I, as your client, have other people that I'm talking to as well? Maybe not so much contractually as far as an agent, but who are some of those other people? You know, or do I have another manager for endorsements? So, do I have somebody doing my financial? No.
So from an endorsement management, we do it in-house because we have a full commercial team, which not only looks after our athletes, mm-hmm. but we also marry corporates with sporting properties. We have incoming, as I said, incoming tours, outgoing tours. We do hospitality. We own a couple of our own events. Mm-hmm. So that commercial team, which is sizable, also looks after the commercial interests of our athletes. Mm-hmm. And it's strange. It's like this worldwide. In South Africa, I can tell you now, 95% of commercial opportunities go to 5% of the athlete population.
Really? Okay.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but it's understandable.
Right, the top
your brands want mm-hmm. exactly. So internally, contractually, and commercially, in terms of the endorsements, it's exclusive. Purely because we've got to manage their daily diaries. We've got to manage the process of how many endorsements they can take on board mm-hmm. without it affecting their playing mm-hmm. career. Because you're only as good as you are on the yeah. field, by the way, today and not yesterday. Mm-hmm. And so we have to manage it extremely carefully. Their time management is important. Their category management of endorsements is important. You know, they might end up with, and I'm going to use a stupid example, a boot sponsor. And if we have another person dealing with their management, they might do an advert for a competitor of their boot sponsor, which is not allowed and is violating their existing contract. So that we are absolutely explicit about. We will not share, not for any other reason, but it makes sense, contractual or commercial opportunities with anybody else, unless it's done through us. So if we have, for example, a company in the States who say, listen, we have one of your athletes that we believe we can do a lot of work with outside of the normal sphere of corporates you're dealing with, we'd like to sit with you and talk about it. We will do a JV with him. And it'll be a specific JV for certain corporates, for certain types of categories. Mm-hmm. So that we will do, most definitely, because we want to do everything in our power to enhance the earnings and the success of the athletes that we look after. In terms of everything else, we offer in-house service for everything else. However, we also give them the opportunity, and we do guide them in terms of engaging their own investment advisors, their own tax consultants, mm-hmm. their own property consultants. But then we will say to them, if you need our input on it, come and sit with us and tell us who you've engaged, and even bring the person you've engaged, so we can at least have an idea as to who you're dealing with, and we can give you an opinion from our meeting with that entity as to whether we think they're the right entity mm-hmm. or not. But we don't prescribe all of those services to our athletes on an exclusive basis. Right.
And you've got 300 athletes. As soon as you said that, I'm just, because you said UK all the way, I mean, even the States to Asia, just all over the world, multiple continents. So I personally love contracts and I love going through the legal jargon and I write my own contracts. Yes. But when you've got so many countries to deal with, so many athletes from one country playing another country, you've got multiple federations, multiple organizations, maybe a single athlete is playing in, you know, multiple organizations or, you know, I can't even imagine how is that managed from a contractual standpoint, from a legal standpoint, to marry and merge the taxes, the incomes,
correct.
All of that.
Valid. So we have a very good relationship that we've built up over the years with some very strong organizations worldwide, whom we will entrust with in that geographical region, exactly what you've said, tax consultation, investment advice, setting up proper structures, legal structures to manage income and revenue streams for the athletes. You might find that our top athletes will have their image rights in a different entity completely, but managed by image rights experts. Mm-hmm. We are experts in our field, and we do the majority of the image rights agreements in South Africa and Africa, but we also realize that different countries have different rules and regulations, different tax structures, different advantages and disadvantages, and we need experts within those territories to advise us. So over the 22 years that I've been involved, we've built up a relationship, a very strong relationship with those that we can really trust with our sportsmen and sports personalities. So that's how we manage it. Each regional manager will be responsible for that relationship. Okay. So for example, if we have a regional manager in Belgium, in football, he'll be responsible for the relationship with the entity that does the tax consultation or the like in that territory. Because the relationship exists between him and his clients, and he's got to then build the trust with the outside entity that is dealing with setting up image rights structures, tax structures, et cetera, through the relationship that our account manager has with our clients.
Okay. Makes sense.
So it's complicated,
but
it's only complicated if you start with 300.
Right. So
it's not complicated when you start the growth process and by the way, the majority of what we've done within our company has been organic. Mm-hmm. So we've grown organic. We'll have interns, we'll educate interns in our cultures and our systems, and we'll then place them in the various offices worldwide. Mm-hmm. And for example, we have a South African in our Swedish office. We have a Greek in our Belgian office. Thankfully, we have a Greek in our Greek office. And we have a German in our German office. But what I'm saying is that the most important thing is that the majority of these people have come through an internship program. The majority of our staff have come through an internship program where they understand the core values and the purposes of the organization. Mm-hmm. And they understand how the organization operates. Right. And and we are very, very mindful of the fact that you've got to embrace our culture. What we can't afford is to have one set of culture in one office and a different culture in another office, because it's got to be seamless. If you, for example, if you're going to move from our South African territory, let's say you're in Johannesburg and now you're moving into Brussels, it must be absolutely seamless for you. You're in a different country, in a different environment. However, the service we offer you must make you feel as if you're still in South Africa and vice versa. And that's what we've attempted to do. And thankfully, mostly successfully in our company.
And like you were saying about your turnover has been very, very little. So I mean, it's very much so. Definitely understandable to keep that culture and to keep that continuity. So, Mike, let's say I'm a kid, you know, every kid, to be honest, frankly, I didn't really know about the sports agency world growing up as a kid, but today or even 10 years ago, I mean, I would be thinking, you know, I'm not going to be an athlete. I no longer can be a professional athlete as I dreamed when I was a kid, but could I merge that with sports? And so if I'm a kid right now in any part of the world listening, what are some of the attributes or what are some of the skill sets needed to be a successful agent and to actually work through the ranks within an organization?
Well, first and foremost, my advice to any kid who is looking to sign up with an agency, make sure your family is involved.
Okay.
At a deep level, okay, because they have your best interests at heart. Make sure that you need an agent for the right reason, not for the sake of saying I have an agent.
Right.
Because that agent isn't going to wave a magic wand and change your life and change your career overnight. Make sure that agent or agency is going to add real value to your career from day one. And therefore, the younger you are, the more cautious you need to be if you're going to become involved with an agent. My advice is don't get involved with an agency until you really need to. And the truth is, you won't have to ask an agent to look after you if you're talented.
Right.
The world has changed. Right. And we're all scouting younger and younger athletes day by day because we've seen it. Younger players are now being blooded at a senior level. The whole transformation has taken place over the years where no longer is a 17-year-old footballer deemed to be too young to make his debut for Liverpool. Or a 19-year-old rugby player deemed to be too young to make his international debut for the All Blacks. So it's a fact that top sports personalities are progressing quite much quicker than they did in the past because of all the technology and help and assistance that's available to them today as opposed to a decade ago. So if you're talented, somebody's going to knock on your door.
Right.
Just make sure that before you say yes to anybody, you've done your homework and you've looked at the success rate that particular person or agency has had with a kid of your age in your territory, in your sport.
Yeah. And then
and make sure there's a great connection because that's the most important thing. It's a connection that is vital. Right. I always say, you know, our youngest kid is 40.
Oh, okay.
We're very loath to look after anybody under the age of 14. Mm-hmm. He actually was 12 when he joined us. But his family really knew who we were, and we knew them well, and they wanted somebody to protect them. It didn't cost them any money, still doesn't cost them any money, and won't cost them any money until he earns his first professional salary, and it then has to be a certain amount because we will not take anything from our athletes if they earning less than what we believe is the bare minimum for us to be able to charge them. So the truth is that even the 14-year-old, what do we do for him? We advise him really on his career and his academic growth. So all we really are is a shoulder to lean on. We're an ear to listen. And that's really what we're doing for him. And the good thing about that is you build a relationship. Right. So by the time he's 17, 18, he's been in your stable for 4 or 5 years. He's part of your family.
He's not going anywhere else.
And when you make decisions for him, And when you make decisions for him, it's not based on what the best financial decision is for you as a company. It's based on what is the best career decision for him. Okay. And what is going to promote longevity in his career? And what is going to be the best step to move him up the rungs of the ladder? Mm-hmm. So those are the concepts any top agent needs to, first and foremost, take the well-being of his or her client into account ahead of everything else.
And on that same note, on the flip side, from an athlete choosing your firm or choosing any agency, how about an individual, a young kid who wants to aspire to be an agent? What would you advise them to look out for as far as what skill sets to work on or what aspects within an organization to work on and skills to hone as they progress in their career?
You know, I think Warren Buffett said this. He said, when you employ people, look for three attributes. Make sure they're intelligent. And I think what he was alluding to there was make sure they understand the industry or have the natural feeling for the industry that they're going to involve themselves in. It's no good getting involved in the IT industry if you don't like touching a computer. Right. You don't know what to do with a computer. So Warren Buffett said intelligence is important. Enthusiasm is important. We all know that. If you're not enthusiastic and you don't put in the hours, you know, you often hear the millennials talk about working smart. Of course you can work smart. But it helps to work smart for longer hours as well. Because I truly believe the more time you put into and invest in your life, the more you're going to get out of your life. And the third thing Warren Buffett said was integrity. He said, make sure they have integrity. And he said, God help you if you employ somebody who has intelligence and enthusiasm but no integrity. And he's right. So first and foremost, guys, if you want to get involved in this industry and you want to be successful in this industry, I think the most important thing is to have integrity, because the truth of the matter is that you're dealing with somebody's life here. You're not dealing with a contract. Right. You're not dealing with a product. You're not dealing with a commodity. And the day you want to look at an athlete as a commodity and as a commercial property, get out of the business, because then you're in it for the wrong reason and the wrong purpose. Of course, we're in it to make money. Of course, we're in it to be successful. But in the right order, we're in it for the right reason. That's to make a difference to the lives of those people that we come into contact with in this industry. The second thing is to ensure that you're successful individually. Because if you're successful, your clients 9 times out of 10 are going to be successful. And the third thing is that you will be financially rewarded, because if you're successful and you're doing it for the right reason, the finance follows automatically. Right. And that's my belief. So what would I look for in a young aspiring person, and what should they be looking to do to impress me as the CEO of a sports management company? Honesty and real sincerity, which goes hand in hand with integrity. Massive enthusiasm. You know, we can talk about passion. I'm passionate about coffee. It doesn't mean I'm going to be successful owning a coffee shop. So let's look at love of what you're doing, and passion is two different things. You have to love what you're doing, but you don't have to be passionate. You can be passionate about doing a hobby. Often people will say, I'm so fortunate. My business is my hobby. It's not true. The minute your hobby becomes your business, it's no longer your hobby, it's your business. So absolutely love what you do. Be enthusiastic, day in and day out, even under the most difficult circumstances, and understand the industry that you're getting involved in. Have a real understanding and grasp of the mechanics and the operational aspects of the industry you're getting involved in. If you want to be involved in this industry, a serious warning, have a thick skin. Because people are going to say to you, don't be involved personally. You can look after a client for 10 years, and when they hit their straps, they can leave you and join another agency. And you cannot say, well, I'm not going to let that affect me personally. Because if it doesn't affect you personally, you haven't done your job. Because you haven't built a strong, you haven't built a relationship, a personal relationship with that person. Yes, it is going to happen to you. Without a doubt, it's going to happen to you. It's going to affect you. But take it as being one of the characteristics of the industry you're in. Because for everyone that leaves you, as long as 9 stay with you, your stats are right, and you're going to get and you're going to be warm. Your heart's going to be warm. You're going to lose somebody today and sign the next Lionel Messi tomorrow. That's how this industry works. So I'm looking for somebody who would be resilient, somebody who honestly would have integrity, have a deep understanding of the industry, sporting industry, and for that would have to have done a lot of homework and reading, and somebody who's prepared to learn and prepared to weather the storm, because you're going to have good days and you're going to have bad days. You're going to have, in actual fact, in this industry, you're going to have exceptional days and you're going to have poor days. And you need to weather the storm with the same enthusiasm and the same gusto as you would on a daily basis.
I love absolutely everything that you just said. And I'm definitely going to take a snippet of that and share that, because everything that you just said, I did not anticipate. But I mean, you're going to that next level, the in-depth level, where you're truly showing exactly what it takes and about the experience of actually having a client after 10 years, after you've built such a relationship, for them to walk away. I'm just envisioning it's must be such a heartbreak, especially when you've built that friendship.
Heartbreak.
But, you know, like you said, you've got to be resilient, because that next guy could be, you know, the next one. So I love that approach.
So let me tell you, we recently looked after a footballer, and I'm not going to mention football clubs, looked after a footballer who joined our stable when he was a youngster, playing in Africa for an academy. We took him into a second tier European league. So the top tier European leagues in football are France, England, Spain, Germany, and Italy. We took him into a level below that. So a level below that would be Belgium, Greece, Portugal, still top levels, Sweden, Denmark, and a number of others. He took 2 or 3 years to acclimatize. We had somebody really take care of him almost on a daily basis. He then made his move to the next level, which was a second level in a top tier European. So if, for example, would be the Championship in England, one below the Premier League, did extremely well, ended up being the top goal scorer in this league at the age of 23.
Oh, wow.
And was then approached by a football agent who had an opportunity for him at a top team in a top tier league in Europe. So what would the right thing have been for him to have done? To have said to the agent, listen, I have an agent that's looked after me for the past 6 years. He's done an unbelievable job of not only looking after me, but looking after my family back home.
Mm-hmm.
He would be happy to work with you because I know the sort of person he is and I know the sort of company they are. Their prime objective has always been my well-being. That would have been the right thing to do. He would have ended up having the same deal. He would have ended up staying with us, and we would have worked with the agent that procured the deal for him. And that agent would have built a relationship with us, and would have been a beneficial relationship for him, because we have a number of these players that are going into world football and world rugby and world cricket on a regular basis. The agent elected to convince the player to leave us and join him, which he did. We had legal recourse to the player. We decided we weren't going to do anything in this particular instance, but only wish him well. Heartbreaking.
Right.
Hey. Tough. But let me tell you, he is doing unbelievably well at this new. So his value when we started with him was probably 100,000 euros in the transfer market. He's moved from the first European club that he went to the second European club, which was in the second tier of top flight football. His value escalated to 4 million euro. His second move now, which is the move that was done without us, 12 million euro. And he is now really doing well in this top flight. My guess, if he continues, his value will sit at somewhere between 30 to 50 million euro. So So we as an agency have lost, thankfully it doesn't, in 22 years, it's happened once to us, maybe twice. We've lost a top class player. We've lost a son, to be honest with you. Do you know that when I pick up on his performances and I see him scoring goals, I send him messages to congratulate him and say, we are thrilled that we were able to play just a little part of your success. Keep it up and know that we're right behind you and supporting you.
That's amazing.
Because that's what you have to do in life.
Right.
You have to release all of that hurt, because it's hurtful. Release all of that hurt and move on.
Right.
Because at the end of the day, if your purpose truthfully is to see youngsters like that prosper, that should be warming, heartwarming. And that is enough.
And that goes exactly back to what you were saying about if you do get hurt and if it's on the financial aspect or the contract basis that you feel some, you know, a different type of way, then you're in it for the wrong reasons. And it should be purely on the best interest for that particular individual. So,
Because of him, by the way, we've just placed at the same club that he started his career in Europe, we've just placed two players who are doing incredibly well.
It's amazing.
So there we are. That's the story you have to look at. And that's the mindset you have to, in actual fact, again, Simon Sinek says, it's not only about the mindset, it's about your mindset and your heart set. Mm-hmm. That's what you have to have in your mind and your heart if you're going to walk this earth with peace.
Right.
Because unless you have peace in your heart and your mind, you ain't going
to
be happy.
And I think that comes back to the resiliency that you were talking about, where it's it's resilient to say, all right, that's fine. But then it's another step where you come to terms with it and you're at peace and say, hey, I wish you the best, you know, keep going, and to keep that rapport and relationship with that, with that friend, or, you know, like you said, it like a son. So yeah, it's amazing.
Yeah. Who knows? We might have the next big deal on the table for
right.
him. Only difference is we'll go to his current agent.
Right.
That's the difference.
The proper way.
We won't go to him.
That's amazing. Yeah. As far as the actual relationship between an agent and the athlete, how does that actually take place? So you as an agent, you're, you know, I'm just envisioning, I'm taking this athlete to a brand new country to play in a brand new league. Don't know the language, don't know anything. Am I walking through kind of the logistics, I find him a good chef, a good trainer on the side. I mean, everything. Am I their best friend? I mean, is there that intimate level of a relationship? And am I physically flying out to go see him on a regular basis? And can you talk about that actual bond and relationship that, you know, like you said, you felt so passionately about? How does that progress throughout the years?
Okay, so that is so important, particularly when you're taking a sports person from one continent to another. Mm-hmm. One country to another is bad enough,
right.
But one continent to another is even more of a culture shock. Different language, different culture, different living environment, different weather, all of these things, different currency, food, everything's alien. It would be remiss of us not to prepare that person for the change and for the transition. So we would do that. We would also spend a lot of time with the club or the organization that is signing him and make sure that they have in place a system which caters for foreign players to ensure that the transition is as least difficult as possible and as smooth as possible. So that preparation work, recon we call it, that recon would be done prior to the player setting foot in that country or at that organization, so that they understand who he is, where he comes from, what his background is, his level of education, his level of understanding of the English language, because normally that's the universal language. Is he shy? Is he outward? Has he got this arrogant confidence so that it's not a surprise when he walks onto the field arrogant? Because that, to be honest with you, that's what coaches love, is when a foreign person walks on and he's got this sort of confidence, not arrogance that is ugly, but a confident arrogance. So we would prepare that prior to the player setting foot on that turf at his new home. And we prepare the player mentally for it. We would take him through where he's going, what the country is all about, the food, the language difficulties he might have. One of the big things is driving on a different side of the road. So here in South Africa, we drive on the left-hand side. Okay. In the States, you drive on the right-hand side. In England, you drive, I think, on the left-hand side, so it's the same. But in Italy, on the right-hand side. So we'd prepare him for all of these things, and we'd get somebody to spend an initial time period with that person, and it depends how mature that person is, and then regularly be in touch or visit to make sure that, you know, it's as seamless as possible. All of that said, that's where the character comes in. Certain people can make that adjustment. Others cannot make that adjustment, irrespective of what you do and what the club does for them. And then there are certain clubs or unions or organizations that are far better at that practice of bringing in a foreigner and helping that foreigner work in a sort of a seamless way with the club. It differs from club to club. It differs from player to player.
That's true.
But the agency does play a very important role in that, because you need to understand those dynamics so that you know how much input you need to give to the club and to the player in terms of giving that relationship a real chance of work.
I can imagine that must be such a, I mean, these are true relationships, and to logistically,
very much so.
And like we were talking about, the so many aspects of you're transitioning their entire life, especially when you said a continent over. And so I can only imagine everything that an agent would have to do in the recon to actually do the preparation, and then thereafter to actually make that transition as seamless as possible. So that's, I mean, getting me a much more clear picture of, you know, the full breadth of what it is an agent is able to do and is doing and needs to do to really secure that outside off the field aspect for an athlete. So definitely amazing. But Mike, thank you so much. I know we went over quite a bit, but I just love talking to you. And
that's what happens when you're enjoying this.
Exactly.
Tom, you don't know where the last, it's almost an hour and three quarters. If you said to me, where's the hour and three quarter gone? I couldn't tell you. And that's by the way called flow state.
Yeah.
Where you're
in the zone.
Such in the zone of what you're doing that time and space are meaningless.
Exactly. Because we're present.
Yes, very much
if,
so.
When I do head out that way, we definitely have to catch up and meet face to face after this time, because
absolutely
love just this. So whenever that ends up being,
and let's do it again in the future when, you know, if you feel there's a time that you'd like to have another discussion with me. It's been great fun, and I had such a good feeling about doing this today with you. I knew it was going to be fun, and I knew it was going to be easy. Some discussions like this aren't easy, but it's so easy to do this when you have somebody on the other side that is also so real. So thank you so much for hosting me. It's been great.
Thank you. I appreciate
great fun.
You joining as well. And like we were talking about before on the transition plan for some of the players and some of the mentorship, we'll definitely, I'll definitely reach out for sure when I can put together some sort of concrete ideas in the coming weeks. But once again, appreciate this. Thank you for joining the Global Luge podcast.
Pleasure.
Thanks a lot, Mike.
And be safe, and just take care.
You as well. Enjoy the holidays.
Cheers.
Take care.
Cheers.
Thank you so much for listening to the show this week. Please do leave a comment on your thoughts about today's episode, and make sure to hit subscribe to get the latest on the Global Luge. Or if you already have, please share with a friend that you think might enjoy.